Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organizes tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce David Reed today, the author of The Brazen Age, a book about 1940s New York and its influence on American culture. David is the editor of Sex, Death, and God in L.A. and the co-editor of West of the West, Imagining California. His essays, articles, reviews, and interviews have appeared in Vanity Fair, The Paris Review, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times Book Review, and in several anthologies, including the Pushcart Prize 12. Welcome, David, to speak about The Brazen Age.
Thank you, George, and everyone for coming. This is a return appearance at the Commonwealth Club, though I can't say they occur with great frequency. The one time I remember working the big room was in a public conversation with an Italian columnist and wit, Beppe Severgnini. The Italian council that sponsored the event. The room was stuffed, and all I remember of it was that Beppe Severgnini had a well-practiced line, which was, "Americans don't like to drink cappuccinos; they like to order cappuccinos." Now, I can't promise anything of this level of witty quipdom for today, but I would like, before going to the slideshow, which is about New York in the 1940s, the era I call the Brazen Age. The phrase I derive from a comment made by Gore Vidal in the 1970s, which some of us here will remember, I think, I can say with some confidence. During the dark days of Richard Nixon's presidency, as they were lurching toward the Watergate scandal, Vidal wrote an essay for the New York Review of Books in which he said, "From December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, to August 15th, 1974, presumably the day in which he was writing, the United States has been more or less continuously at war, except for a brief, too little celebrated interregnum between VJ Day and the outbreak of war in Korea, when the empire turned its attention to peaceful pursuits and enjoyed, if not a golden, at least for us, not too brazen an age. Long ago, when my editor, my agent, asked if I had a book to write, I said I would like to write a book about that period. I did not realize then that I would spend a lot more time circumnavigating New York, a city in which I had never lived, and have not lived since, I should add, than that period itself, that period itself lasted. That was the origin of the book. The background to it, of course, is how the United States, led by New York, really, it's sort of Macedonia, emerged from the Depression under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt and then to victory in the Second World War, again, under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt. So I think it's appropriate in this venue to note that perhaps the single most historically significant address ever done at the Commonwealth Club, in the view of many historians, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's address to the Commonwealth Club during his 1932 campaign against Herbert Hoover. It was about this time that Herbert Hoover had said that if Franklin Roosevelt were elected president, that grass would grow in the streets of 1,000 cities. FDR at that time was not quite yet FDR. He was not thought to be anything more by some people than a rather amiable gentleman, as Walter Lippmann once put it, who's very much wanted to be president. Events would prove Walter Lippmann for once was wrong. And I think that the thoughtfulness of the address that he delivered here gave a portent of that. And since FDR was both a great New Yorker and a great American president and a person who had a very intimate relation with the shaping of California during his years in office, I think I'll just begin with a few lines from the address that he made to the Commonwealth Club in 1932. And there might be some notes that will strike there might be a note of deja vu about all of this. Said Roosevelt, "A glance at the situation today only too clearly indicates that equality of opportunity, as we have known it, no longer exists. Our last frontier has been reached. There is practically no more free land. There is no safety valve. Eastern economic machines can go nowhere else for a new start. We are not able to invite the immigration from Europe to share our endless plenty. We are now providing a drab living for much of our own people. The independent businessman is running a losing race. If the process of concentration goes on at this rate, at the end of this century, we shall have all American industry controlled by a dozen corporations and run by perhaps 100 men. Plainly, we are steering a steady course toward economic oligarchy if we are not there already. Roosevelt proposed that under the circumstances, it was time for a reappraisal of American values. And in some ways, that call for a reappraisal remains as cogent as it was in 1932 when he addressed the ancestors, I assume, of the people who are happily coming here today at the Commonwealth Club. Now to New York. This is a photograph by Berenice Abbott, the great American photographer, perhaps the most variously talented of all American photographers. She began as a portrait photographer during the Jazz Age. Her portraits of figures like James Joyce are literally iconic in the sense that if you have a copy of James Joyce on your shelf, that's going to be, you know, it's going to be her photograph on the cover. He's wearing a sort of a piratical eye patch. In another, he's wearing a peaked hat and carrying a cane, looking very Irish Renaissance and pensive. This is the financial district of 1939. It suggests, you know, endless power, you know, Faustian upthrust, and, you know, the buoyancy of American capitalism. Appearances are deceiving. During the Depression, the financial industry had lost more than two-thirds of its value. A lot of these temples of mammon were virtually empty. The banking industry had received a severe shock from which it had been rescued somewhat unwillingly by New Deal measures, which began by Roosevelt's bank holiday, which occurred in the beginning days of his administration. So here you see a paradox, the topless towers, and yet the fact that they are, in a way, sort of mausoleums to what people thought was going to be a vanishing way of life. Moving on from this, I don't want this gavel to interrupt this. Okay, now here we see, this is a street scene. This is a scene by Weegee, the famous photographer of New York crime. Weegee complained of situations like this that his great prejudice against the New York Times was based on the fact that they would not publish pictures of dead gangsters, no matter how eminent. He had to rely on other audiences like the New York Post and the Daily News. And here, I don't know if you can see it exactly, but the eminent dead gangster is in his roadster. He's slumped over. And here we see Weegee with his camera inserting himself into the picture with his speed graphic. This was what people thought the future of New York might well be at the time Roosevelt took office. It really seemed as if it might be turning into a kleptocracy, that there might not be a way to stop gangland from taking over the arteries of commerce, essentially. There were those who stopped that, Franklin Roosevelt and also Thomas Dewey, the boy prosecutor who became his opponent in the 1944 campaign. But in the early 30s, those expectations really were live. People thought that New York was going to start resembling a kind of Dashiell Hammett novel. Now, this shows us at the end of the era covered by the book. These are the troops returning from World War II, from a troop ship, the Joseph F. Connelly, which would subsequently be represent the dead in a single coffin which was carried to the Sheep's Meadow in Central Park. Here, of course, they're going through Washington Square in Greenwich Village. So here we go from the stricken city of the Depression to the city which had arrived at the summit of the world 12 years later. Now, this is VJ Day. And it shows you, I mean, this is Little Italy on Mulberry Street, which is the heart of Little Italy. And you can see that what the soldiers are returning to was still really an urban nation. Sometime, and I imagine by now the calculations are possible to do on some supercomputer or maybe just on a laptop. Sometime, some night in roughly 1946, the balance turned. During the war, more Americans lived in absolute numbers and proportionately in cities of over 100,000 than ever before or ever since. They were stopped in that moment. No one was building private housing that wasn't for war workers. during the war, and precious little that wasn't public housing had been built during the Depression. People were still in city pent, as Wordsworth would say. And this is what it looked like. There's another photo. There's a famous drawing which makes the same point. Norman Rockwell, when the Saturday Evening Post asked him to do a picture of a GI returning to his joyous family, he didn't do somebody returning to a house behind a picket fence in a suburb. He went exactly to a tenement in a big city like this, with clothes hanging on clotheslines outside and ragged-looking kids. And that was the city that stood at the summit of the world. This is a somewhat unexpected picture, which gives joy to the heart of publishers. During the Second World War, a consortium of publishers sent something approaching 135 million paperback books to soldiers in the armed forces. At the same time, the new paperback publishers, Dell, Anchor, Pocketbook, thrived to an extent that Bennett Cerf, the founder of Random House, a hardcover house, said was positively frightening. It seemed that that reading at this point was actually the principal form not only of distraction and entertainment, but of consolation, of simply of passing the time to an extent that now seems pretty much unimaginable to us. There are poignant stories about how soldiers in the field would gather up around the trucks that were bringing the loads of pocketbooks and magazines. And literally, as one soldier finished a signature in a pocketbook, he would tear it apart and hand it to a comrade to read that, rather than waiting until he finished the entire book, although it was known that sometimes officers would hijack some of the racier numbers and even some of the classics. It's a poignant fact, for example, that some authors that seemed on the verge of being forgotten were recovered at this period, most famously F. Scott Fitzgerald. In the last year of his life, F. Scott Fitzgerald's royalty checks totaled $17. It was the war that made The Great Gatsby into an American classic, not really the Jazz Age, which it seemed not to have survived. Now, this is the city room of the New York Times at the end of the war. Now, it's interesting because you will see not only like the foreign desk, but there's also a wire desk as well. And you also have to infer the filled ashtrays, the gin and whiskey bottles and desk drawers. There was this common saying at that time. Now, some of you who were around in the 40s will recall or who have read about it, that at the time, the New York Times had a real classy rival, the New York Herald Tribune, which was, in fact, the establishment newspaper. It was the Republican suburbs subscribed to the Herald Tribune, not to the New York Times necessarily. There was an obscure saying, I've never been able to verify exactly what it meant, that said, the curse of the New York Times is sex, and the curse of the Herald Tribune is drink. But I've got to say that drink inspired better writing at the time. And in some ways, the New York Times today is actually more like the Herald Tribune. I mean, the many things like New York Magazine, a lot of the feature writing, lifestyle writing, arts criticism really was pioneered in the Herald Tribune. And it was a sad day for New York when Jock Whitney, its publisher, decided that even he couldn't afford to lose any more money on it. That happened about 1965. Now, this represents, of course, the empire of the air that's coming. This is Edward R. Murrow, who many of you will recognize, if only from many documentaries, the most famous broadcaster to emerge from the war, who also became a great foe of McCarthyism, but had a somewhat difficult and turbulent time during the sort of Mad Men era of communications during the 50s. This was his colleague, Eric Severide, who wrote a once famous bestseller called So Wild a Dream, about coming back to New York after reporting on the war in Europe in 1940-41. And one thing that you have to remember about this period is that New York was a neutral city right up until Pearl Harbor. Right up until Pearl Harbor, Nazi officers in full regalia were perfectly free to walk the streets. There were people in theaters who cheered Hitler's victories. America was not united on the issue of the war right up until December 7th. And Severide is perhaps the most eloquent testimony to the befuddlement he found when he came back to greet that. For as far as he was concerned, the country had been at war since 1939, but that was not at all that case. Now, this is a sort of gathering of intellectuals associated principally with partisan review and politics. The 40s in New York was an era in which the Little Magazine exercised an extraordinary sway. It was where fiction writers were discovered, where the reputations of poets like Delmore Schwartz were made, where the great political issues were argued out, like whether we should be involved in the war at all, or whether intellectuals should wait for a socialist revolution. Partisan Review had begun as an official organ of the communist-based John Reed Society. It turned anti-communist and embraced a kind of combination of modernism and Marxism, anti-communist Marxism, which was enormously influential right up through the mid-60s. Probably the last major public intellectual to be discovered by Partisan Review was Susan Sontag. And that was going from Delmore Schwartz to Susan Sontag was a pretty good record. In any event, we're going from left to right. We have Bowden Bowright, a novelist who was best known for being married to Mary McCarthy, who was over there. Niccolo Chiaramonte, an expatriate Italian intellectual who had a great sway on the opinions of sort of in-crowd of the intellectuals. Elizabeth Hardwick, who was subsequently married to the poet Robert Lowell, a notably stormy marriage, and a founding editor of the New York Review of Books. Miriam Chiaramonte, unidentified figure. Mary McCarthy was best known for the novel and movie The Group. Anybody with long memories remember The Group? It was a tell-all story about Vassar. Then we have, stage on the right front, her brother, the actor Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy is actually best known for his role in a horror film, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Now, surely a number of you have seen that. It is Kevin McCarthy who stands on the road outside Santa Rosa saying, trying to stop hail motorists saying, "You've got to stop. They've come," remember, because the pod people have arrived and all of his friends have been turned into pods. And, of course, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was remade some years later in San Francisco. With a number of scenes shot at Minerva's Owl. I don't know if anybody remembers that bookstore, but the inside joke was that Leonard Nimoy was a self-help author who was attending a book event at Minerva's Owl, and of course, Leonard Nimoy was really a pod person. And he might have been. Now, here we have a representative figure of the post-war Jewish intelligentsia. Here is Arthur Miller, the archetype of the earnest and moralistic Jewish intellectual and artist. And he is shown here in a sort of classic plaid shirt mode during the time of the great success of All My Sons, which preceded Death of a Salesman. And for an equally well-publicized artist of a rather different style, we have the young Truman Capote, who was, approximately 19 at this time. There is a legendary story that when he met Gore Vidal at a party at Anais Nin's, he said in atrocious French, "How does it feel to be an infant terrible?" But actually, and actually he himself was, published his first novel, I think, at 19. This is Leonard Bernstein at the time that he had become sort of the idol of the classically minded Bobby Soxer. It was said that young women, and I presume some young men, would yell "Lenny, Lenny" at his concerts as fervently as they said "Frankie, Frankie" at Frank Sinatra's. And at this time, he was working on the Town, which of course is in production to this day, and had already established himself in a legendary performance on CBS Radio when he had to stand in for an ailing Bruno Walter. To the right is Salvador Dali, who looks fairly respectable in this photograph. And the mustaches are nothing extreme by today's standards, or even then, with his dealer in Midtown. But he stands in for the European expatriate artists, the painters, the novelists, the philosophers, the linguists who came to New York in the 1940s and made it a real golden age for everything from, in his case, avant-surrealist art to, say, Hannah Arendt in philosophy and historical studies. And it was an age that ended with the artist with surprising quickness. The French and the Spanish tended to go home as soon as they could. The Germans, for whatever reason, tended to linger. And these are the dancers of the City Ballet, an art which, interestingly enough, was so relatively rudimentarily developed in America that in the great WPA guide to New York, it isn't even mentioned. It was really during the kind of myth-haunted period of the war that ballet, especially, that directed by Balanchine, really grew a mass audience in New York. And in fact, the first public space that was not related to the New Deal arts projects devoted to an art in America was the City Ballet that LaGuardia, a great fan of opera and ballet, dedicated. And speaking of the arts, here once again we see Balanchine to the left and Lawrence Hart, the composer of musical comedies. Lawrence Hart preceded Oscar Hammerstein with Rodgers and Hart, and are known for all sorts of slightly moody musicals of the 1930s and 40s. Now, this is a sort of classic gathering of sort of golden boys and girls of this era. It's a problem because one can't always be sure how many golden boys and girls are going to have any currency after a while. I was somewhat dismayed reading in the Times Literary Supplement recently that someone said, well, of course, the problem is nobody under 50 knows who Gore Vidal is. And I thought, well, this is bad news for the book because this is the picture that introduces it. This was taken at a fashionable cafe in the East 50s. To the left, there is Tanaquil Leclerc, who was married to Balanchine, who was a ballerina who tragically developed polio in her late 20s and never walked again, but indomitably made a second career as a teacher and was apparently an inspiration to a generation. This is Donald Wyndham, a novelist. This is, I think, Elizabeth Anderson, who was one of the proprietors of the restaurant, which was the Cafe Nicholson. This is a painter, Buffy Anderson. Of course, we've got Tennessee Williams here and Gore Vidal. This was published in the first issue of a magazine called Flair, and Vidal says that such is the magic of Kim Bissinger's photography that though it is in black and white, we all appear in golden light, and to state the obvious, we were all very young. This is a group of the painters who were called the Irascibles, which is to say the abstract expressionists. Among the notables, including one who played a role here, was Mark Rothko, who had a great breakthrough in his art while teaching in San Francisco in 1947-48. There's Theodore Stamos, looking sort of broody and Greek over there. The woman is Hedda Stern. Below her, to her left, is Willem de Kooning. Jackson Pollock is the balding guy looking sardonic, a sort of professional pose. This photo was taken after Life magazine followed up an editorial in the Times complaining about a group of artists who had held up placards protesting being excluded from a show at the Metropolitan, and they had called them the Irascibles. They then tried to get all the painters together and said, "Why don't you hold up your placards on the steps of the Metropolitan and we'll photograph it." They insulted, they turned this idea down and said, "You'll have to photograph us as we are." So Life, they took them to the Life studio in Midtown, and there they are. And I don't know how many of you have been to the New Whitney yet, which has a magnificent show currently up of its permanent collection of abstract expressionists. But there they all are, and actually Hedda Stern is the first one that you see as you walk in. Now, this is Betty Parsons, who spent time in California in the 30s, whose gallery represented many of the abstract expressionists. This, for something entirely different, is the offices of the Masses magazine, which was the great dissident magazine of the 1910s, the magazine that represented socialism, that said it would conciliate nobody, including its readers. If some of you might have seen or remember the Warren Beatty film starring himself, Reds, about John Reed, in which Warren, in which the editor of the Masses, Max Eastman, was played by George Herman, even though notoriously he was the good-looking one and should have been played by Max by Warren Beatty. But anyway, it was a classic scene of dissidents earlier in the century. This is the house of Mabel Dodge Lewin, who was the sort of hostess to the avant-garde earlier in the century, and at the end, by the period of this book, was living in New Mexico, in Taos, which she turned into, or helped to turn into, the art center that it is today. And here are some women of the avant-garde, politically and in fashion. There's Juna Barnes to the left, Max Eastman's sister, Esther, and Berenice Abbott, the photographer whose work we have seen. And here, coming to round things out, we have, I'm sorry, this is a photograph of the 1948 campaign. There is the handsome man with holding a child seated among school children is Henry Wallace, who had been Franklin Roosevelt's radical wartime president and who ran as the third party candidate as a progressive in 1948 against Harry Truman. And standing in back of him is Woody Guthrie. And this was kind of the last call for a certain kind of left, a certain social democratic vision that you didn't see again for a long time. But I'd be willing to bet that if Bernie Sanders had been 21 in 1948, he would have voted for Henry Wallace and not Harry Truman. And this, on the other hand, is the sort of scene that Harry Truman despised. There is a letter that he wrote in 1948 to his daughter, Margaret, in which he said that the only people who opposed his foreign policy were Reds, lunatics, and the corrupt and decadent writers and artists of Greenwich Village. So here are some of the decadent writers and artists of Greenwich Village. There's Montgomery Clift to the left, who is speaking to Kevin McCarthy. The women are unidentified. The quizzical-looking man my editor scoured Manhattan to find. We never did identify him. And attending to his spaghetti is Jack Kerouac, the enemy as defined by Harry Truman. And here, to round it out, to bring the story to San Francisco, really, we have Jack Kerouac and his camarado, Neil Cassady, shown about the time that he was beginning the transcontinental adventures that became On the Road. So this is sort of, you know, a brief photographic journey through this period. And the two points I wanted to make, having exhausted much of the time on this photographic survey, is that New York in 1948 really did stand at the summit of the world. Roosevelt had enlisted many of the financial and legal elite that he had quarreled with in the 1930s, during which period he famously said at an address at Madison Square Garden that what he called all the forces of hatred and reaction are united against me, and I welcome their hatred. But by 1940, a number of these people, you know, certainly people who were admired by the people who detested Roosevelt, were brought into the wartime administration. Notably, Henry Stimson, a fascinating figure, who had actually fought in the so-called Indian Wars of the 1880s, and who during the war was at the very top of the Manhattan Project to build the bomb, you know, all in one lifetime, and only in America. And so when Roosevelt, conducted the campaign, which begins the book, he went during his famous 50-mile tour of the five boroughs of the city, during which he was witnessed in his passing by 3 million to 3.5 million Americans, most of them cheering. It symbolized this moment of New York arriving to this point of supremacy. On the other side of the continent, we have San Francisco. San Francisco and New York are fascinating as sort of historical antitypes, and it seems reasonable to concentrate on that, however briefly, since I, after all, am here, and am concluding my mini book tour here, where the book began. At this time, what San Francisco shared with New York was its internationalism. Kenneth Rexroth, the poet, critic, philosopher, was kind of the oracle of the city in the 40s and 50s, was a sort of serio-comic figure in the sense that he seemed comical because of his pretensions to know everything, who very often startled people by turning out to know everything. Certainly, you know, I've been told this over and over again by poets like Michael McClure, who would say, oh God, we listened to him on the radio, and he sounded like Major Hoople in the comic strips, and he had a ridiculous accent. And then I realized, but he really did know everything about prosody, or he really did know everything about entomology, or he really did know everything about the history of socialism and anarchism. And Rexroth liked to maintain, not wholly originally, but with great fervor, that seas and coastlines unite, and land separates. That San Francisco was actually part of this great global, maritime global city. And in a real sense, was as close to London as New York, and of course, much closer to Japan. So that after the war, you had this kind of cultural confluences going on here, which were perhaps unparalleled, even or especially in New York. He liked to note, for example, that with the exception of New Orleans, the significant exception of New Orleans, San Francisco was the only major American city that was not separated. It was not colonized overland. You didn't have covered wagons coming into San Francisco. You had adventurers coming by sea. And that from the very beginning, had made the difference between New York and all other American metropolises. He notably said at one time, this being Rexroth, that though San Francisco had been compared to Barcelona and Marseille, it was actually, after the Second World War, a more genuinely Mediterranean city than either Barcelona or Marseille. And that right up through the 60s, it was ruled by a spirit of dulce far niente, which was unprecedented in American life, and which sadly didn't survive that period. So one symbolic figure of this time, I think, is the city's, forever poet laureate, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And I'm going to close with Ferlinghetti just because it's a tale of two cities combined in one extraordinary biography, which many people don't know, despite the fact that he has been a great figure, a beloved figure of San Francisco for so many years. Lawrence Ferlinghetti actually grew up in a kind of reverse version of Oliver Twist. He was abandoned by his mother during the flu epidemic of 1918, during which his father, who was much older, was in his 50s, which was old for a father in those days, had died. His mother went mad. Ferlinghetti was taken in charge by his mother's sister, who took him to France, where he actually learned to speak French as his first language. Came back. She became a governess to a wealthy family in Bronxville who lived a few houses down from the Kennedys in the 20s and 30s. It's often forgotten that the Kennedys really, during their formative years, the second generation, were really New Yorkers, not New Englanders. When Bobby Kennedy, since we just mentioned Bobby Kennedy, ran for the Senate from New York in 1964, he was accused of being a carpetbagger, and he would say, "But I'm an old Bronx boy." Now, of course, as Lawrence Ferlinghetti once pointed out to me, Bronxville is not in the Bronx. But I think that Bobby was making a fairly sound point. In any event, in the fullness of time, Lawrence Ferlinghetti was a boy, became the ward of a wealthy older couple, the family that had endowed Sarah Lawrence College. So we're talking about fairly serious money. Was raised as a sort of lonely little rich boy, joined the Navy, where he rose to become the captain of a ship, burying people at sea, commanding a landing boat at D-Day, and discovering during leave when he went to visit Greenwich Village for the first time that there were actually people who had values which were not those of Bronxville. Finally, in 1950, after working at Time Inc. in a humble capacity as a copy boy, he decided that he was going to make his way west because, as he said, it was all just too tough and avaricious for me in New York. So I went west, young man, and he always insisted that he went in a covered wagon. Anyway, thank you so much, and if there are any questions, I would be delighted to entertain them. Yeah,
thank you.
Yes, yes, they are. I hope you approve of them. But yeah,
they're lovely.
Yeah, no, I was very lucky.
All right, I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that are listening to David Reed speak about his book, The Brazen Age, about New York in the 1940s. So, next question. We'll use this so that all the questions are recorded. Who would like to ask the first question? Good.
What was the role of Henry Stimson in the Manhattan Project? We know about Leslie Groves and Robert Oppenheimer, but not Henry Stimson.
Well, it's interesting because at the very top of the, because as you know, the Manhattan Project was part of a larger project called the S1. And it involved, when we think of the Manhattan Project, at least I think most of us, we'll think immediately of Los Alamos, where the bomb was actually designed and its components were assembled under the direction of Robert Oppenheimer, who, of course, was a figure in the Bay Area and lived in Berkeley. And the S1, however, was that Stimson was in charge of, charged with the facilities at Hanford, Washington, and Oak Ridge that developed the very elements and the machinery, and also on top of the pyramid of command, including General Groves, that determined the delivery of the atomic bomb. So Stimson was the one person who stood atop all the departments of the effort to build the bomb, which was the biggest and most expensive secret of the war. And one of the services to humanity that he did do in this course was that he very narrowly saved Kyoto, because General Groves was bound and determined to destroy Kyoto because he thought that would be a very big shock to the Japanese, even though it had no military significance at all.
Thank you, Mr. Stimson.
Yes.
Yeah. First, compliments. It was a terrific presentation. It was a terrific presentation. Parenthetically, my parents were part of the world you're writing about here, and I suspect they were in that crowd that showed the troops marching through Washington Arch. And we lived on 3rd Street in Greenwich Village,
okay,
and so on.
You're my ideal audience.
but my question is sort of simple and maybe not so simple. Why do you end in 1950?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I think partially to relieve my editor, who thought that I had gotten involved in a project that I could potentially spend a lifetime on, and I spent a fair portion of a lifetime on it. What I liked was the way in which Vidal noted how in 1950 a lot of things went crashing down with the outbreak of the Korean War. That we were back on a war status. The anti-communist furies, which had been barely contained, were totally unleashed by the outbreak of it. Because there was this feeling, which the famous British historian Sir Dennis Brogan enunciated, that Americans thought that if they could have won the war, they could do anything. So if something went terribly wrong, such as the loss of China or finding ourselves at war again, it had to be because evil forces had made it happen. So we entered into a period of great paranoia at that time. So I think that's part of it. And also I think it fits the title, vice versa, because, I mean, in mythology, as I realized much after I finished the book and was asked this question, in mythology, the Golden Age becomes the Brazen Age because the weaponry is bronze. The mythology that we go back to was all Bronze Age, and that's exactly what happened with the Brazen Age. It was continued to be an age of brilliant art, abstract expressionism, great American novels, Mailer, early Roth, Auchincloss. One could go on, but it was all shadowed by war. And of course, the poignant thing is, it's been shadowed. Our American life has been shadowed by war ever since.
Maybe this wasn't the focus of the book, but I noticed you omitted all the silent people, the leaders of Wall Street, the people who really ran New York, you know, Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and Chase Manhattan and all those giants of finance, which probably wouldn't have made New York available to these people with this great cultural efflorescence.
Well, it's a funny thing. It was, I think it would terrify my editor to realize this, that at one time, At one time, the book was at least twice and perhaps almost three times longer than it was. And there was a very long chapter about Wall Street. I mean, what's interesting about Wall Street is Wall Street did not uniformly, for example, oppose FDR. There's a marvelous book called Old Money, written by Nelson Aldrich, as in Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, Nelson Aldrich's cousin, in which he said that his father, you know, Nelson Aldrich Sr., the famous banker, the person who ran Citibank, was not Citibank Chase, was actually an admirer of FDR. He said many of his father's friends on Wall Street thought that FDR was a dangerous man, as all great men should be. They were in the minority. I think a fascinating figure at this time is Charles Merrill, whom I wrote almost 100 pages about, just because Charles Merrill, as in Merrill Lynch, who was known to Wall Street as Good Time Charlie Merrill, and who had a great time during the Jazz Age, but in partially in response to the New Deal, he closed down most of Merrill Lynch in 1929. Foreboding what was going to happen. When he reopened it, it was much more of a people's enterprise, as you'll remember. The whole idea was that they would send trailers out to get, encourage people to invest in the stock market after World War II. And a lot of this was tied in with his relations with his son, James Merrill, the great poet. I would have loved to have had more about Wall Street in the book, but I think at one point, to be candid, and those of you who have written books will know how this worked, my editor came up with a subtitle, and I just thought I'm going to have to stick with the stuff that she's decided really matter. But I agree. The Wall Street was terribly important in this period.
Yes. Can you say something about how the picture, the way we were, Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford captured the spirit of this period in New York?
You know, that's a fascinating question because I probably had that in mind at various points. And I don't know if you have you read Arthur Lawrence's memoir, which covers this period? No, it's fascinating. I mean, Arthur Lawrence, it's a book called Arthur Lawrence by Arthur Lawrence. And he was this multi-talented, rather difficult man who, among other things, besides the way we were, he did the book for West Side Story, numerous other musicals, and also some of the early problem plays and movies that came out after the war, like movies about, darling, what was the one, and Snake Pit, about issues about mental illness. And it's interesting because he was a Red, as he confessed. I mean, I don't think he was – he probably made his party meetings difficult, but he was very, very much a man of the radical left. And, of course, the way we were captures that, that milieu in New York and in Hollywood. Surely everyone remembers the way we were, but in that film, obviously Robert Redford represents what he feared he might have become. I mean, the compromised figure who wanted the $10,000 a week salary, and what did all these old communist associations mean anyway? And this did happen to a great many people, obviously. And they're all very elderly now, but I think one can remember, as late as when Elia Kazan was given an honorary Oscar, you could watch that on television, and half the audience was cheering, and the other half, led by Robert De Niro, who came from very old bohemian stock, were sitting on their hands. So yeah, that battle is still with us.
You alluded to this earlier, but would love to learn more about how FDR kind of loosened the grip that organized crime had on commerce in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that this is the situation that FDR inherited. I mean, the fact was that the gang slayings were routine. That much of city government, when he went into the White House, there was the sort of genially corrupt mayorship of Jimmy Walker. Now people canonize LaGuardia, but in his time, people were very nostalgic to Jimmy Walker. They thought, well, this was a great time. He was a boulevardier. He wrote popular songs. He hit the nightclubs rather than breaking up slot machines. He wasn't moralistic. But seriously, at the time, and if you could find this in very odd places, like H.G. Wells, did a book called The Shape of Things to Come, and various other imaginings of the world, especially America in 200 or 300 years. And he imagined America as sort of becoming what Russia was during the 90s and the teens, but basically ruled by an oligarchy controlled, but which was essentially organized crime. And it seemed a perfectly plausible expectation. And FDR, and his, presided over appointments like Thomas Dewey, who really took on organized crime. I mean, Thomas Dewey is largely forgotten now. The only thing people remember about him is that he lost to FDR. But at the time, John Gunther, who wrote a great book called Inside USA, which I recommend as a kind of political guide to this period, said that what astonished New Yorkers about young Thomas Dewey was not his star chamber methods or his mad avidity for publicity, but just the startling fact that he was honest. And he said this was a real commentary on the state of civilization in New York at the time, that this should come as a surprise. We don't worry about that so much.
You mentioned an anti-communist fury that went on all over the country. But maybe I had bad history teacher, but I feel like McCarthyism focused on Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So if those artists were so influential, why did he focus on Hollywood and Hollywood artists instead of New York artists?
Why did I not focus more on Hollywood than
why McCarthy and FBI and in the all anti-communist?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. Actually, I'm glad you raised that point, because many people get this very confused. They think that the House Un-American Activities Committee was run by McCarthy, which it wasn't. McCarthy was a senator, and he had a Senate investigating committee. But there's this wide confusion. McCarthy tended to focus, frankly, on mid-level government employees, by and large. There were slogans which were once household words, like who promoted Peres, and like who God's name knows who Peres was. And he really didn't take on very many big targets until he took on the Secretary of the Army, and that turned out to be the first of several fatal mistakes. The HUAC, on the other hand, did concentrate a lot on Hollywood. And it startled the movie industry. As it happens, my editor's father, Walter Wanger, was a major producer in Hollywood during that period, and her mother, Joan Bennett, which some of you who are fans of film noir might remember, was very much involved as a... Both of them were very much Roosevelt Democrats, especially Joan Bennett. I think that, as I say, HUAC really was more drawn moth-like to the glamour of Hollywood and had a lowering effect for many years. I mean, there were tragic cases, as I'm sure you're aware, like Clifford Odets, who had been a great star of the left in New York and then in Hollywood was widely perceived to have sold out for the sake of his swimming pool. And that did not have much to do with McCarthy. I mean, obviously, there was this paranoidal humor. It's something that strikes America periodically, but it strikes in different places with a different intensity.
You mentioned earlier about how FDR was not FDR when he ran for president. It's always very interesting to get back into the mindset before then. And I was wondering if you, and this statement by Hoover that grass would grow in the streets was very radical statement that this other guy would make a terrible president. Can you compare the elections during this period, the national elections and their effect on New York, to what's going on now where we have two New Yorkers running?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it allows me to take an indulgent trivial pursuit. Actually, it's a fascinating thing. I don't know how many people here are New Yorkers or have done time in New York? Okay. Yep. Okay. Oh, that guy. I know that one, West Side Story. over there. It's fascinating. Leaving aside earlier campaigns, beginning in 1900, from 1900 to 1944, with only one or two exceptions, every presidential election had a New Yorker either at the top or as vice president of one of the two major parties. In the case of 1912, you had Theodore Roosevelt at the head of a third party, which nonetheless polled second. Roughly half of those elections, the New York candidate was a Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt ran three times, FDR ran four, total of seven. You're talking about half of the time, roughly 24 years of the first half of the century you had a Roosevelt in or very close to the White House. Since then, of course, this, you know, in 1944, you had Thomas Dewey, governor of New York, running against Franklin Roosevelt, ex-governor of New York, president of the United States. And then nothing for many years. Dwight D. Eisenhower had been president of Columbia, but he didn't identify with New York. Richard Nixon was elected from New York in 68, but God knows New York never embraced Richard Nixon as a New Yorker. There's a wonderful story about how after Watergate, when he finally returned from New York in disgrace and found that that he couldn't get into a co-op, he bought a townhouse on 72nd next to the house of the eminent historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. The press went to Professor Schlesinger and asked what he thought, and Schlesinger replied, "There goes the neighborhood." But now, as you say, for the first time in practically 60 years, willy-nilly, the next president is going to be a New Yorker, and the campaign is going to be fought between two New Yorkers. But they represent but it's fascinating because they represent two very different kinds of New Yorkers. In some ways, Hillary is the more indicative. I mean, we all know Donald Trump is from Queens, grew up in the construction trade, which he's now abandoned for branding. Hillary Clinton represents more, in a strange way, the Dewey kind of New Yorker, person from the Midwest who comes to the big city and laid siege to its foundations and ultimately, we shall see, certainly rises to the heights. You know, the difference is that she had a rather interesting second, if ever one thinks of the sentimental falsity of F. Scott Fitzgerald saying there are no second lives in American life, all you have to do is look at people like Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. There's nothing but second acts in American life.
We have time for a couple more questions. Anybody have another question?
You look like you're formulating one back there.
Yeah, I am. I'm trying to think of how I want to ask it.
All right.
I'll be a little verbose if you allow.
Yeah, do be verbose.
So you make the claim that there was a clear good and bad during the Brazen Age, and as you call the Brazen Age. Today, as we're in one of the longest standing wars, I think, that we've ever been in. What do you think is the effect of not having any longer such a clear good and bad on American political leadership?
You think it is unclear right now? I'm not...
Yeah, assuming it's unclear right now, given that we're in this ongoing war, and it's not so clear any longer what America's kind of role is in the world, what do you think is the effect that is having on American political leadership? Mm.
I think we're going through a real time of troubles and confusion, and I think if you're cold-blooded about this, one of the fascinations of this period for a historian, and for the time I'll assume that role, but I write as someone who writes books, not as someone who addresses lecture classes. I think what we're seeing is what might be called, we're living in a time of the breaking of nations. Essentially, we're certainly living in a time of the breakdown of orders. The Roosevelt New Deal order proved to be surprisingly resilient domestically. I think, frankly, FDR would have been astonished to find that 60 years after his death, that the most radical, at least the most professedly radical presidential candidate is far more conservative in his aims and limited in his ambitions than FDR was in 1944 when he said every American should have a job, which he said was the most fundamental economic freedom of all. We're a long way from that. Nonetheless, we still have Social Security, we still have the SEC, we still have the FCC, we still have most of the regulatory props. They go through good times and bad, times of peril, they've survived, they've been surprisingly resilient. What I think is definitely imperiled now is the international order that was established during and after the war. I think that the whole project of post-war liberalism, Once it evolved into neoliberalism, got into deep and uncharted waters, and that's pretty much where we're embarked right now.
One last question.
Yeah.
Is your next book going to be about how this most magnificent, vibrant, powerful entity of Manhattan in all aspects slid into dystopia in the late 60s and 70s?
That's a very good question, and I hope to address that. The next book I'm going to write, apart from a short book about Franklin Roosevelt, at least I promise it's going to be short, is a book that I am writing with my wife Jane L. Walker, who is the scholar. And which has largely to do with poetry, politics, and media in the Bay Area. But there's no way of writing about the Bay Area in the 40s, 50s, and 60s without, you know, a running contrast at some points with New York. Because, yes, it's absolutely fascinating. You do have a city that goes from the top of the world in 1945 to a city in which, you know, two-fifths of the population wanted to escape in 1964. Revert to Gore Vidal, who said that New York was a glittering Babylon before the writing appeared on Mayor Lindsay's wall. Yeah. and that's something that I'm looking forward to getting to. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.